If you turn over, please, to Jeremiah chapter 49, we want to read a few verses here out of the middle of this chapter and take a phrase as our text. As I indicated this morning, we want to preach upon the Titanic, a tragic story full of spiritual lessons. We will read from verse 23. Concerning Damascus, Hamath is confounded and Arpad, for they have heard evil tidings, they are faint-hearted. There is sorrow on the sea. It cannot be quiet. Damascus is waxed feeble, and turneth herself to flee, and fear hath seized on her. Anguish and sorrows have taken her, as a woman in travail. How is the city of praise not left, the city of my joy? Therefore her young men shall fall in her streets, and all the men of war shall be cut off in that day, saith the Lord of hosts. And I will kindle a fire in the wall of Damascus, and it shall consume the palaces of Ben-Hadad. Amen. We'll end there at verse 27, and we know the Lord will bless the reading of his word to our hearts. The context of the chapter is Jeremiah pronouncing judgments against different nations. We have just read the part that deals with Damascus. But I want to take the words of the end of verse 23, we're taking them entirely out of context, but there in the end of verse 23, you'll notice those words, there is sorrow on the sea. It cannot be quiet. In the year 1899, Joseph Bruce Ismay succeeded his recently deceased father Thomas and became the chairman and the managing director of the famous shipping White Star Line. As a young 37-year-old, he had a great head for business, and the company flourished under his leadership. 2 years later, in 1901, Bruce Ismay agreed to merge his White Star Line into the newly proposed International Mercantile Marine Company, which was heavily financed and promoted by J.P. Morgan, the wealthy New York financier. It was a golden age for shipping. And particularly it was a golden age for transatlantic shipping because of the high rate of immigration to North America. Over the next 6 years, up until 1907, Bruce Ismay oversaw the building of four ocean liners to surpass anything that his father had built in his time. Those four ships were called the Big Four. They were called RMS Celtic, RMS Cedric, RMS Baltic, and RMS Adriatic. These vessels were designed for luxury, more than for speed, and all of them were built in Belfast in Harland and Wolff. The last one of them, the Adriatic, entered service in 1907. But still not to be outdone, not content with what he had, in the year 1908, Bruce Ismay announced an even grander project. The White Star Line was facing a growing challenge from their main rivals, Cunard, who had just launched the Lusitania and the Mauretania. There was also the competition that was coming from the German passenger liners. Those two liners that Cunard had built and launched were the fastest ships that were then in service in the world. And in the face of this challenge, Bruce Ismay proposed the construction of two magnificent new steam liners that would eclipse every vessel that was then afloat. Ismay and the White Star Line decided that they would compete on size as well as on speed. And that new class of liner would be bigger than anything that had gone before, as well as being the last word for comfort and luxury. A third ship was to follow, eventually, in the series. Again, the two ships would be constructed in Harland and Wolff. They had a long association with Harland and Wolff, and Harland and Wolff itself had to be rebuilt to accommodate such a vast project because of the size of the ships. The two ships were originally numbered 400 and 401, and that signified the number of ship hulls that had been laid down at Harland and Wolff shipyard up until that date. They later would be renamed RMS Olympic and RMS Titanic. Olympic would weigh 45,000 tons, Titanic, when she was fitted and completed, would be slightly heavier at 46,000 tons due to some of the upgrades that were made to her before she was launched. That was about a third bigger than any vessel existing at that time. A third bigger than any vessel that was existing at that time. Titanic was 269 metres in length. No budget was agreed for her. With the Harland Wolff shipyard, they were given quite a free hand in how they would build her, how they would design her, as long as they had the agreement with Bruce Ismay and the White Star Line. It's reckoned that she cost in the region of £3 million. Now, I came upon a calculation because of some other donation that Bruce Ismay made at the time. And if you work out the corresponding cost for £3 million back in the early 1900s to what it is today, we're talking somewhere in the region of £1 billion today would be the equivalent cost of building just one ship. The shipyard got a fee of 5% to build each one of the ships in the White Star Line. An estimated 100,000 ticket holders watched the launch of the Titanic in Belfast on the 31st of May 1911. In that crowd of 100,000 people stood Bruce Ismay, the chairman and the managing director of the White Star Line, and also J.P. Morgan, the great New York financier. 22 tons of soap and tallow were spread on the slipway to ease the ship's passage down into Belfast Lock. And in keeping with the White Star Line's traditional policy, the ship wasn't christened or named with champagne, as it was the practice with a number of other shipping lines. She was towed out into a fitting berth, where over the course of the next 10 months, her engines, her funnels, her superstructure were installed and her elaborate interior was fitted out. After being fitted out, she went for sea trials. Among the things that were tested on the sea trials in the Irish Sea was a crash stop, where the engines were reversed from full ahead to full astern, bringing her to a stop in 777 metres, or 3 minutes and 15 seconds, before she could stop. She then sailed for Southampton, arriving in Southampton at midnight on the 4th of April 1912. As you know, on the 10th of April, she sailed on her maiden voyage. She collected some passengers at Cherbourg. She wasn't able to dock because of the size of the ship and the smallness of the port, so they had to bring out the passengers that were going to come on the Titanic by tender. The same again at Queenstown, or Cobh as it is now in the south of Ireland. Again, she couldn't dock because she was such a large vessel. And then she headed for New York. The rest, we say, is history. On Monday night, the 15th of April, around 10:45 ship's time, she hit the now infamous iceberg. 5 of Titanic's watertight compartments were punctured, and it soon became clear that the ship was doomed, as she could not survive more than 4 of those compartments being flooded at one time. At 2:20 a.m., the ship's time, the magnificent Titanic had sunk out of sight with a loss of 1,514 lives. And as you know, it's the whole story because of the 100th anniversary of it at the present, and the talk about it and the discussion about it. And I want tonight to consider some things about this tragedy, and in doing so to draw out some spiritual lessons, because there's many. There's more than enough that we can think about tonight. We might come back again to this, God willing, next week as well. But there's many spiritual lessons out of the circumstances surrounding this ship and the iconic image that she is and the story that lies behind it. And I want us to consider some things. First of all, I want you to consider the foreshadowings of Titanic's fate. The foreshadowings of Titanic's fate. You know, there's a number of forewarnings of her impending doom. Listen to the words of one of her passengers when he got on the boat at Southampton. A man by the name of Colonel Archibald Gracie. He died. He survived the initial sinking of the Titanic, only to die 8 months afterwards from his injuries that he received. But in that space of 8 months, he wrote a book, The Story of the Titanic. And he talked to people, he went to the inquiry in New York and listened to the evidence that was given. But he was a first class passenger on the Titanic. And when he got on board that ship, this is what he thought. And he later on wrote it down, put it in the book. He said, "The pleasure and comfort which all of us enjoyed upon this floating palace, with its extraordinary provisions for such purposes, seemed an ominous feature to many of us, including myself, who felt it almost too good to last without some terrible retribution inflicted by the hand of an angry omnipotence." Now that man made no profession of following Christ. Made no profession because he goes on to tell about himself and others during the course of the voyage and what happened when she was sinking. And he made no profession of knowing God or following Christ. And yet when he got on the boat, that was what struck him. The opulence and the luxury that was there. It felt as if it was too good to last without some terrible retribution inflicted by the hand of an angry omnipotence. Listen to the words of Mr. Charles Hayes. He was also on board the Titanic, but he was the president of the Canadian Grand Trunk Railroad. And this is what he said when he got on the boat and saw the opulence of it. He said, "The White Star, the Cunard and the Hamburg American lines are now devoting their attention to a struggle for supremacy in obtaining the most luxurious appointments for their ships. But the time will soon come when the greatest and most appalling of all disasters at sea will result." How prophetic were those words? Little did he know that that boat, that ship that he was getting on with all the luxury around him was going to be the one that would go down to the bottoms of the ocean. There was an incident with the Titanic in Southampton Harbour. She just had left the dock. It was only minutes after she had left, and it was a near disaster because as she passed two moored liners, the SS City of New York and the SS Oceania, her huge displacement caused both of those smaller ships to lift up with the bulge of the water and then to drop down into the trough. And it says that the New York's mooring cables could not take the sudden strain and they snapped. And the New York swung right round stern first toward the Titanic, almost colliding with the Titanic. In fact, they said there was only 4 feet to spare between the stern of the New York and the side of the Titanic. That actually delayed the leaving of Southampton because they had to wait until they got the New York under control. But is there not a lesson in all of those things? Does God not also give foreshadowings and forewarnings about the impending doom that unconverted sinners are facing in this world? He certainly does. He warns against loving the things of this world. He warns against being taken up with trivial things and the things of time and sense and pursuing the pleasures and the luxuries of this world. He warns about those things over and over and over again. Does the Lord warn about those things? Love not the world nor the things that are in the world. That's the Lord's command. And yet what lay behind that great ship was a love of the things of the world, a love of luxury, a love of ease, a love of opulence. And God gives ample warning in His Word that we are not to love these things. We are not to pursue these things. He warns in His Word as well of death and judgment that is coming. Remember those words in Job 36 verse 18. It says, "Because there is wrath, beware. Beware." There is many a warning that God gives in His holy word about our impending doom. We're not going to go on forever. Certainly if we seek the things of this world and live for the pleasures of this world, we're going to come up short. We're going to lose out. And you don't need to be a prophet to work that out. God Himself has said it to us in His word. He makes it clear in His truth that if we pursue these things, then we will lose out. What will it profit a man if he gain the whole world and he will lose his own soul? And we could be doing the very same thing. Oh, maybe in a much lower level, never to the same extent as what lay behind the Titanic, but still we could be pursuing the same thing. The same spirit can be manifest in our lives, where we are looking for the things of the world and following the things of the world and wanting the things of the world. And all the time the Lord tells us, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. Because they're coming to a sudden end. They most certainly are. Something else we can consider with regards to the Titanic is the Titanic's unmissable date with destiny. You see, in the days and weeks after the tragedy, and even more so over the years and decades since, there's a multitude of ifs and maybes surrounding her sinking. What if this had happened? What if the other thing had happened? Things then would have been so different. And that's true. It's true. Hindsight is always is a great thing. Looking back and saying if things were done differently, if circumstances changed a little, it wouldn't have ended up the way it did. And that is very true. Do you know that Titanic's completion was delayed in Belfast by the need to repair the Olympic, her sister ship? Work had started on that sister ship Olympic 4 months ahead of the Titanic, and therefore she was finished and completed and launched 10 months before the Titanic. She made her maiden voyage. But as they were working upon the Titanic in Belfast and completing it out, the Olympic was in a collision in September 1911. And so great was the damage that was done to the Olympic that she had to be brought back to Harland and Wolff for repairs. And because of the work that had to be done to get the Olympic back sailing, and again remember there was all the pressure because of the transatlantic routes and the competition from these other liners, there was great pressure to get the work done and get her back into a sailing mode so that she could be put back into service. That delayed the launch of the Titanic. Until April 1912. And humanly speaking, looking on at it, that little circumstance put Titanic then in the middle of that ice field. And it came her turn to launch out on her maiden voyage and make her way across the Atlantic. She was right at that very time, in April 1912, at that very moment she was amidst the ice fields that were floating down from the North Pole. As well as that, Titanic underwent some last-minute alterations, which again delayed her launch even further. And it ties in what we've already been mentioning there, this idea for luxury and grandeur. It says at the last minute and at the personal request of Bruce Ismay, the chairman and the managing director of the White Star Line, a steel screen with sliding windows was installed along the front half of the A-deck promenade. This was intended to aid the shelter of the first-class passengers, to make it more luxurious for them, that they wouldn't get any spray coming up from the ocean as the ship would make her way forward. And as a result of that particular addition and some other additions, that's why the Titanic ended up being 1,000 tons heavier than her sister ship Olympic. Because of these additions, they were to be exactly the same. They were to be two exactly the same ships built to the same design. But because of these additions that were asked for by Bruce Ismay, it delayed her return and, as I say, it made her that little bit heavier. And again, humanly speaking, it seemed, well, if that didn't happen, she wouldn't have been at that particular point at that time to hit that iceberg. Something else that feeds into that, and that is that icebergs were not usually found that far south in April. It was the testimony of a number of old sailors that not for 50 years had there been so great a mass of ice and icebergs seen so far south as there was in 1912. And as I say, looking on, humanly speaking, people could argue, had Titanic not faced those delays, had she been finished earlier, had she been launched out on her maiden voyage that little bit earlier, she would have missed that rendezvous with the iceberg. But again, is there not a spiritual lesson to draw from that? Surely one obvious spiritual lesson that comes from that tragedy is that none of us can ever escape our meeting with destiny. And what is our meeting with destiny? It is appointed unto men once to die, but after this the judgment. We can't escape meeting that day. It doesn't matter what circumstances we might think could have changed or otherwise. We're all heading one way and we're all heading for that meeting. With death and with judgment. And there's no escaping that rendezvous. Because our lives are in the hand of a far greater power. Far greater power. There is a sovereign God who rules in this world, who overrules all things in this world. And He it is who governs our days and who governs our time and our circumstances and all the events of our lives. And there's one thing that is sure and certain amongst it all, amongst all the things that are uncertain in life. We're heading for a meeting with death. And as Hebrews 9 tells us, after death the judgment. And we cannot escape that meeting. There is no way of working around it. There's no set of circumstances that we can bring about that somehow is going to escape that. And wouldn't we be far better facing up to that inevitability? And yet how many today don't? How many never think about the day of their death? And yet it's one of the certainties of life. One of the certainties of life. One of the things we can be sure about in life. We're going to die. And yet people seldom think about it. They don't want to think about it. They close their mind and their ears to it. And you could be here tonight and close your mind and your ears to the very thought of death. And any word or any talk about it. Wouldn't be the first person that didn't want to talk about the day of their death. Because you don't want to think about what it means. After death, the judgment. After death, there's an eternity. You go out to meet a holy God. And surely when you think of those circumstances and how they all came together that brought the Titanic at that particular hour right against that particular iceberg, does it not remind us there are some things inevitable in life? And one of them is death and judgment. And would we not need to prepare? Would we not need to prepare? Another lesson that we can draw from the sinking of the Titanic is the pride surrounding the building and the operating of the Titanic. There was generally a presumptuous, hubristic spirit regarding that ship. Everything that you read up about regarding the planning and the building and the operating of that ship has the stench of arrogance and conceit on the part of those who were involved from the start to that very sudden end that Titanic came to. Listen to the words of Eva Hart. She's a survivor from the Titanic. In an interview before her death, she only died in 1996. But here's what she said. The wreck of the Titanic is a monument to man's arrogance. The wreck of the Titanic is a monument to man's arrogance. And how true are her words? Let me give you some things that support that. We've already mentioned, but just to draw it to your attention again, it was the desire of Bruce Ismay, the chairman, the MD of the White Star Line, that he would have something bigger and better than anything else before. And remember, the Titanic and her sister ship Olympic was to be a third bigger than any ship that was then sailing. A third bigger. William Perry, he was the chairman of Harlan and Wolff at the time. He was involved in the plans. And they wanted to take on the Cunard line. The Cunard had her ships built elsewhere. She didn't build any ships in Harlan and Wolff. As I mentioned, the Lusitania and the Mauritania. They were bigger ships than anything that the White Star Line had before Titanic and Olympic. They were more luxurious than anything that the White Star Line had before Olympic and Titanic. But these ships that Bruce Ismay wanted to build in Belfast, they were going to be the last word. They were going to be bigger and better than anything else. And surely at the back of that, there's pride. There's pride. Bruce Ismay wanted the fastest sailing time to New York. He was a passenger. Bruce Ismay was a passenger. We'll come to mention him, maybe not tonight, or if we don't get that far, but he was a passenger on the Titanic. The man who was the chairman and the MD of White Star Line. He was determined. As that ship started out across the Atlantic, he was determined that ship, the Titanic, would complete the journey in a record time. He wanted to be able to say and to boast that the White Star Line and her ships had the fastest crossing to America. And to achieve that, it is said that he put considerable pressure upon Captain Smith to maintain the speed of the ship at all costs. And even when warnings were given, Bruce Ismay still persuaded the captain and put pressure on him to keep going. He wants to get to New York in the fastest time. He wants to be able to put it on the posters. He wants to be able to boast that the White Star Line has got the fastest ship travelling from the United Kingdom to New York. Full steam ahead. The story is told that how on board they announced an early arrival in New York. If I remember right, I forgot to write this down, but if I remember right, there were something like 400 nautical miles from New York when the Titanic sunk. And yet, long before she sunk, they had announced that if they would keep on going as they were because of the progress they had already made those days across the Atlantic, they would arrive in New York faster than any other vessel had done that trip. Is that not presumption? Is that not the pride of man coming to the fore? The failure to recognize that our times are subject to a sovereign God and to the circumstances of this world, and that very quickly things can change? I'm sure we're all aware to some degree of the description unsinkable that was given to the Titanic. Now, there's great debate that has arranged around the use of that term with regards to the Titanic, and who used it and how it was used and so on, but there's no doubting the fact that the term unsinkable was used repeatedly about that ship. Let me give you some examples. There was an extract from a White Star publicity brochure produced in 1910, now long before she was ever launched. But this publicity brochure was produced in 1910 for these two ships, the Olympic and the Titanic, and here's what it states on them, and I quote, "These two wonderful vessels are designed to be unsinkable." That was their boast. They are designed to be unsinkable. That was the view of Thomas Anders, the Titanic's designer. And the reason why he said that was the new concept that he came up with 16 watertight compartments. However, there was a fatal flaw in his design. In all his confidence that he had in himself and in his design and in the fact that she was designed to be unsinkable, there was still a flaw. We see man's ways are not perfect. Man doesn't know the end from the beginning. And Andrews and his other designers made a fatal flaw. Because as the first compartments began to fill with water when she struck the iceberg, they started to lower the bow of the ship. As you can imagine it would, with water being taken on board. And as she lowered in the water, the more she lowered in the water, it was discovered that the bulkheads that he had built in and designed into the ship to keep the water from going from compartment to compartment were not tall enough. And as she took on water, and as the bow of the Titanic began to sink in the water started going out over these bulkheads into other compartments. And the very thing that he thought would make the Titanic unsinkable didn't make her unsinkable. Andrews was on board as well, leaving Belfast and then Southampton. He was on board, and when she struck the iceberg, he went down to inspect the damage as low as he could into the bowels of the ship. And when he heard of the damage and heard of the reports and saw the water coming in and into the different compartments, he concluded to the captain that the ship could not be saved. His great plan had come to nothing. It is reported that Captain Smith said to him, "How much time do we have?" And Andrews reported approximately 2 hours. And within 2 hours, Titanic was at the bottom of the ocean. You see how God can bring the plans of men to nothing? Do you see how even the best plans that men have and the best ideas are still worthless? They don't know everything. Oh, he thought she was unsinkable. And there's many an individual living today, and they think they're unsinkable. They think they're untouchable. They think that they could never take sick, or something could never happen to them suddenly, and they'd be ushered out into eternity very quickly. There's many an individual today lives like that. And surely thinking about the Titanic and what happened to her and the boasts that were made regarding her ought to remind us all, we are just frail individuals with limited knowledge and limited ability. And even in the face of the elements in this physical world, we are no match for them, never mind the match for a holy God. But on the 1st of June 1911, the Irish News and the Belfast Morning News carried a report on the launching of Titanic's hull. And the article in those two papers described this system of watertight compartments and the electronic watertight doors, because this was a novelty, this was a new design that had been come up with in passenger ships. And having discussed and reported on these new developments and this new system, they concluded that the Titanic was practically, and I quote, unsinkable. They used the word unsinkable about the Titanic as well. Titanic's Captain Smith, while he didn't use the word unsinkable, he certainly declared the sentiments that lies behind the thought. Here's what he said, and I quote, that he could not imagine any condition which would cause a ship to founder. Modern shipbuilding has gone beyond that. Now, it is said that Captain Smith was on his last voyage. He was actually due to retire. He was the most distinguished captain of the White Star Line. And they give him the honour of captaining the Titanic to New York, possibly back as well. And then he would retire. Oh, how foolish he was to make a statement like that. That he could not imagine any condition which would cause a ship to founder. Modern shipbuilding has gone beyond that. And he was made to heed his words. As we know, modern shipbuilding had not gone beyond that. And there were circumstances in which a ship could founder, even a mighty ship like Titanic. One final use of that term, unsinkable, when the New York office of the White Star Line was informed that Titanic was in trouble. The White Star Line Vice President, P.A.S. Franklin, this is what he announced, and I quote, "We place absolute confidence in the Titanic. We believe the boat is unsinkable." Do you know that when he uttered those words, Titanic was already at the bottom of the ocean? She had already sunk. And there's that man making the boast. "We have absolute confidence in the Titanic. We believe the boat is unsinkable." Oh, what folly. And surely there is a lesson there for us. God has a habit of bringing down man's arrogant plans and reminding us that we are but puny creatures that cannot conquer the sea. Do you notice that text that we were pointing you to there in Jeremiah 49 verse 23? There is sorrow on the sea, it cannot be quiet. Man cannot control the sea. The sea is controlled by God. And there's a power in the sea that man can certainly harness at times for his own good and employ for his benefit. But there's a power in the sea that can overrule him, overpower him. How foolish it is for men to utter words like that. That a boat, that which was planned and designed and made by man, was unsinkable. Now, the story has been told that people said God couldn't even sink her. Whether that was true or not, I do not know. I certainly haven't come across that quote in anything I've read about the Titanic. But there were people, I've heard it said, that people said that about the Titanic. God couldn't even sink her. Well, as I've given you evidence and quotations, there were certainly people that said this. It was certainly the idea behind many and the thinking among many that this boat could not be sunk. And yet she came crashing down. You see, our best plans are subject to a sovereign God. Man proposes, God disposes. And in Proverbs 16 and verse 18, it tells us, "Pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. And is that not obvious about the Titanic? And the disaster that ensued cost so many lives. Behind it lay pride. Behind it lay pride. There was not enough lifeboats on the Titanic. There was space for 64 lifeboats. That's the specified number that ought to have been on the ship, both on the Titanic and on the Olympic. However, there were only less than a third were installed upon the Olympic and upon the Titanic. 20 lifeboats out of 64 that should have been and could have been on those boats were on the Titanic. And the reason why there was only 20, it wasn't that they didn't have the materials, it wasn't that they were rushed and they didn't get them on in time, it was because they wanted to avoid cluttering the deck and to provide more space, particularly for first class passengers. The deck that the boats were on was the first class deck. And that's the reason why they reduced the number of lifeboats. So that the first class passengers who had paid considerable sums of money could have a better view of the sea. That they wouldn't be looking out of their windows and their cabins and their luxury apartments that they had and looking into a lifeboat that was there for their good and for their safety. They decided, we'll dispense with some of these lifeboats. We'll only take 20 out of 64. That was only sufficient for one third of her possible crew and passengers. There was only room on the lifeboats for one third of all the passengers that she should carry. It said, even shockingly, to think about it, that a number of passengers refused to board the lifeboats when the call was given and the command to get into the lifeboats. There were those who refused. Now, there were certainly individuals who refused. For example, the Strausses, who owned Macy's famous department store in America. She stayed with her husband and would not leave him. She was offered the place on the lifeboat. And if I remember right, her daughter maybe stayed as well with her father. They would not leave. And that man, Colonel Gracie, that I mentioned, who wrote the book, he was on the Titanic actually as she went down into the waters. And he saw the Strausses sitting on the deck as the waters came out over the top of them and swept them to their grief. There were certainly people like that who would not get into the lifeboat, even though when they knew she was sinking, even though when they knew she was not going to last. But before that, before it became apparent that she was going to go down, there were people who refused to get into the lifeboat. They believed the ship to be indestructible. They believed that she could not sink. This is the Titanic, after all. This is this massive vessel who has been so described. How can she go down into the sea? And they wouldn't get on the lifeboat. What folly is that? And yet, is there not a spiritual lesson in that? Are there not sinners tonight, and that's how they live? People may witness to them and speak to them and warn them of judgment to come, tell them there's a fearful eternity, there's a heaven to gain and a hell to shun. And what do? They do exactly the same. They won't get into the life raft. They won't flee to Christ. And you can be here tonight, and that's exactly how it is with you. You can be told of heaven and hell. You can be warned that you need to be saved and that you need to come to Christ. And yet you don't do it. You don't come to Christ. You don't seek the Savior. You won't get into the life raft. You'll perish just the same way. How many there are who think they'll be all right, good enough as they are, only to discover someday they're going to perish. They're going to perish. The story's told of the band that kept playing. In fact, it's one of the iconic parts of Titanic's story about the band that, well, there actually were two bands on the Titanic, and they joined together and they came out on the deck when all the people were congregating on the deck and they were getting a number of them into the lifeboats. The two bands joined together and came out onto the deck. They started to play. Now there's great debate as to what it was they were playing. Some people say that they were playing those two hymns that we sang tonight, Abide With Me, and the very last one that they played was Nearer My God. To the others dispute that and say that it wasn't the case at all. But whether it was or not, again, is there not a spiritual lesson in that? Too little, too late. Oh, up on, when the journey was going well, they didn't have a thought of God. The band then didn't play Abide With Me or Nearer My God To Thee. They had no thought of God when everything was going well. It was only when trouble came and she begins to go down and there's this realization, we're sinking and we're going to be lost. Then they start to cry out unto God. Too little, too late. Every one of the band members perished. The story is told that they kept on playing till the water came up the deck as she lowered into the water and swept them away. Too little, too late. Is that how your life is going to end? Too little, too late. How many people are there who think that in death they'll cry to the Lord and He'll save them? It's true, there are deathbed repentances, but I'll tell you, there's very few of them. There's very few genuine deathbed repentances. Oh, there's certainly deathbed repentances, like the dying thief on the cross who cried out to the Lord. There was one. Maybe it was J.C. Ryle, I'm not particularly sure, but it was some preacher of a bygone dead said there was one to give us hope, but only one. That we might not presume. You mightn't have a deathbed repentance. You might never have the opportunity to have a deathbed, never mind repenting of your sins and coming to the Lord on your deathbed. Is that how your life is going to end? Too little, too late. You see, your hopes and dreams can come crashing down in minutes. Oh, it can all end. The Lord can bring it all to a close very quickly. And you can discover then, to your ultimate eternal cost, that you have made insufficient preparation for eternity. And when you think of the Titanic and the tragedy and the disaster and some of the circumstances that we have been drawing to your attention tonight, I trust the Lord will write a spiritual truth upon your heart. And even use it to speak to you and challenge you. Your little life can come to a close and you can be found out having made insufficient preparation. What an end. What must it be like? There's many drawings and depictions. There's no photographs taken of the Titanic sinking, but there's many drawings and sketches made of that mighty ship going down into the water. But what must it have been like to be on her? As she went down, what must it have been like to have been in some of those lifeboats watching her go down? What must it have been like to hear the cries of the people in the water? And that man, Colonel Gracie, that I mentioned there a moment to you, he talks about that in his book. How he put his head down. He clambered up onto an upturned lifeboat. There were 35 of them on it. Nobody else could get on it. They knew if anybody else gets on it, we're all going to sink down because there's too many people on the lifeboat. And he says he just put his head down so that he wouldn't have to look at anybody in the water. As he heard the howls of people crying for deliverance. But there was no hope. No hope. Could you die tonight and that would be said of you, no hope. No hope. No hope. I'll finish with this. As I say, we'll maybe come back to it next week. There's many other things. But I'll finish with this. Do you know that in New York, the news came through that the disaster had taken place, and then there was a great desire to find out who had survived. You can imagine in the office of the White Star Line in New York, they put up a list. Saved, lost. referring to those that had survived and those that had perished in the sea. And there was a list of the sea of those that had escaped the watery grave. There was a list of those that they knew were not on any of the boats. And there were those two lists, saved and lost. And I wonder tonight, which one of them are we going to be on? Are you on the list of the saved? Or are you on the list of the lost? May God teach us tonight the need to be in Christ and among the saved. Let's bow in prayer.